This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 4th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 73rd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we're taking a hop, skip and a jump across the globe to cover all corners of cultural life. For this week only, I'm going to be plucking rabbits out of hats, donning a spangly waistcoat, referring to myself as the great Roberto and all that tricky jazz. I am a magician and here's my roster of tricks. You want film? Come to Ouagadougou, where we attend the Fespaco Film Festival.
Africans do not see African films. This is the only place where we can see them. Our governments need to understand that, but they don't.
Books, I hear you cry, will attend Lahore's first major literary event.
One of the things that's happened is, for one thing, our own writers are drawing huge crowds, and that is because there is a tremendous kind of pleasure that one gets about reading about your own country.
And music, well, enter stage left, Cold Specs, for a beautiful Midori House session, and Jamie Liddell, the man who's relocated from London to Nashville for musical inspiration.
I always wanted to live in Nashville because you can... You know, this is a place where you can do stuff, you can really create and you don't get distractions.
Plus, we'll talk art in Saudi Arabia and ask why Norwegians are keen for slow TV. Magic indeed, throw in a saw, a prestige, a couple of beautiful assistants and one very large wand. And you have this, episode 73 of Culture, with me, Robert Bounds, right here on Monocle 24. So to kick off the show, and in a slight change to our normal order of play, we're going to play a track from Jamie Liddell's new record. It's simply called Jamie Liddell. That's guts for you. The track is called You Naked. See what you make of this. And that was Jamie Liddell with You Naked. And we're going to meet the man now. He's a Renaissance man. How often do you get to say that? Well, precisely. Liddell is a soul singer, a beats practitioner, a loops aficionado, a funk merchant, and electromeister. He's a Brit who's achieved plenty of success on both sides of the Atlantic, but he's recently up sticks to Nashville, home of country, to, yeah, make an electro album, simply called Jamie Liddell. So what's going on? I asked him.
All we knew was we couldn't afford to stay in New York and kind of, in a way, grow our lives. My studio equipment was like all stacked in the corner of the apartment, and it was bringing me down, and it was bringing us both down, like having nowhere to create ultimately. In the apartment below, they could hear every word we said, you know.
I mean, you know you're in trouble, though, especially when it's a studio and your next door, you can hear your next-door neighbours coughing or turning over in bed or something. And
well,
then you think,
right.
Oh, hang on.
Yeah, no, it was that. So Nashville, I remember when we first moved there, I was like, I had my band in to rehearse. We had a small handful of shows and I needed to put drums and like bass and make some noise in the house. And I was so scared, you know, I was like, oh, the neighbours, we've just moved in. We can't be cranking this. But of course, no one could hear anything or care. I mean, there's this thing people in Nashville say, oh, yeah, everyone's making music, it's welcome.
And how does that, and how, I mean, everyone has an idea, sort of, as you said, as you guys had when you moved there as well, a preconceived idea of what Nashville is like.
It's all
and
true.
And all the rest of it, it's all about sipping whiskey and, you know,
yeah,
front
right.
porches and all that kind of thing. But as a musician, it is, you are kind of entering a whole new world. You're entering the place where you're not an alien. You're part of, you're part of the culture. You become part of the culture, I guess, very quickly.
It's a small town and you do meet people quickly. In fact, it was remarkable how quickly it all happened for us. We had a friend, a great guy called Pat Sansone, who's part of the band Wilco. He was the one, in a way, that just said, oh, you should think about Nashville. He used to be, you know, a resident there, and he always had these crazy stories. And when we first went there, we're like, we just didn't get it, you know?
Yeah.
It just felt like part of Middle America. Not that Middle America is bad, but it just didn't seem to have this charm, really inviting charm. On the sort of the shallow impression of it was really like, I don't know about this.
It's tough coming from New York.
I think
he lives in Berlin as well. These
right.
are kind of like, we think of them as quite avant-garde, sort of contemporary creative cities. And Nashville seems like it's got, you know, so a cowboy boot in the past, right?
Right, right. I mean, yeah, the airport, you can buy a Taylor Swift towel. You know, there's plenty of Nashville. There's plenty of reminders. But we had this party. We ended up finding a real estate agent whose story alone is a classic Nashville tale. I was going to buy a mixing desk for the house, and I was getting this fancy kind of old English Oxford-made console from the 80s. And she was like, why do you want to buy an SSL? You know, it's a weird choice. And I was like, well, what do you mean? What do you know about it? And she's like, oh, I used to work at Skyline Studios in New York.
Right.
That's how I met my husband, Roger Moutinho, who happened to be the guy behind all the Yola Tango records and has done work with Lou Reed. And, you know, Bruce Springsteen, you know, no big deal.
So you can't even have a conversation in Nashville without someone being the husband of someone. Yeah.
Well, it's literally like that, though. It's insane. The guy who helped us build stuff in a house, our kind of handyman, is an amazing, humble guy. Turns out that he's a Grammy Award-winning engineer in his own right, and he kept it shtum. So it's like, it's one of those where I was like, people had warned me that this might happen. And I was just, you know, you dismiss it, you brush it, and you shouldn't, because it will probably happen to you. So, I mean, in the first week, basically, we were there, we met like Harmony Korine and like Patrick of the Black Keys, and like in one party, in one room. And they all came up to us, especially Harmony, saying, oh, you got to move here, it's brilliant. You know, I always want to live in Nashville because you can, you know, this is a place where you can do stuff, you can really create and you don't get distractions. And that really appealed to me. That all of those boxes were ones I wanted checked, you know. As much as I love living in cities, there's so many distractions for an artist. I mean, in the year that I made my new album, I also made two others with friends, and you know, they could all come to the house for the first time ever, actually stay, had rooms, and we would cook, and there's that sense of different time. In fact, there are ways, I think people in New York have a sort of, I don't know if desperation is the right word, but there's a lot of hustle, you know, and then people are constantly reminding you, like, oh yeah, you know, don't forget, I do this, and I did some work with David Byrne, and you know, you just, everyone's name dropping, and it's like very full frontal. In a way that I wasn't used to come from Berlin. Berlin is more aligned with that Nashville thing in a way. It's like people are comfortable to make, but they're not necessarily going to be like gloating, or there's not an urgency to it. Maybe it's just because it's cheaper, you know? I mean, there's a lot of reasons, I'm sure, but it's that kind of sense of ambition and how you go about it. Nashville's kind of nice like that. Because like I said, the guy, I had to pull it out of that guy. It wasn't like he was coming over going, actually, you know, I've won a Grammy, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't like that at all. I think there's a certain sense that people leave the big cities to go to Nashville. Some of the ones that we found, like, you know, transplants from, you know, New York and LA, they just want to get away from that hustle a little bit. You know, you can go down Roberts, you know, a classic kind of like Nash Vegas kind of haunt right next to the Ryman, and, you know, steeped in legend. You know, Johnny Cash would go there and pass out, and, you know.
Just to pass out.
Yeah, after a show at the Ryman, yeah. Everyone would go there, and like these like honky-tonks and stuff. And, you know, you can get a little taste every now and again when you take, when you and your relatives come, you might take them down there, just remind yourself that where you are,
yeah,
kind
right.
of thing. But those players, they truly... They make it seem like it's nothing, you know. But it kind of, I guess for them, it is almost nothing, because it's just like, you know.
It is what it is.
Yeah, it's just like talking.
That was Jamie Liddell there, and his new self-titled album is out now on Warp Records. Check it out. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound I. Africa's biggest film festival opened its 23rd edition in Ouagadougou, capital of Burkina Faso, last week. The winners of the gongs, including the top Etalon d'Or prize, were announced on Friday. The biannual festival has been the subject of criticism in recent years for its disorganisation and failure to keep up with other film festivals around the world showcasing new African film. But this year, the display of 101 films from around the continent suggested that FESPACO may not have lost its touch just yet, as Rose Skelton reports.
A red carpet covered in a thick layer of Ouagadougou's ever-present dust runs through a street in the city centre and up to the steps of one of the city's only functioning cinemas. Performers on stilts mingle on the steps alongside men selling toy film projectors fashioned out of recycled Coca-Cola cans. A mixture of African film directors and cinema-goers from around the world are here to watch the latest in African film. While the queues trail out of the doors and into the excruciatingly hot air, a band plays in the cinema's courtyard, and a barbecue sends out clouds of fragrant smoke. Over the din of the crowds, Senegalese director Ousmane William Mbaye explains why he wanted to show his documentary at the festival. He has no doubts about the importance of the event, but he is conscious that the nature of African film is changing.
Pour moi, FESPACO, c'est le festival le plus important du continent.
For me, FESPACO is the most important festival on the continent. There are other festivals now that are beginning to become important, but FESPACO has been around for 44 years. When FESPACO started, there were no other festivals on the continent. For us, it's a chance to meet the African film professionals.
Nous, on a changé notre fusil d'épaule.
We have changed our strategy now. We don't make films for a cinema anymore. We make films for television, so we look for distribution on television while we wait for politicians and businessmen to build cinemas.
The theme of this edition of FESPACO is African cinema and politics. But while African filmmakers say they make films to show Africans their own lives, there are hardly any cinemas left in Africa where these films can actually be seen. Senegalese director Moussa Touré agrees.
We need to make films, but we have no cinemas. Africans do not see African films. This is the only place where we can see them. Our governments need to understand that, but they don't.
A highlight here at FESPACO, Moussa's film La Pirogue, meaning the canoe, picked up an award at this year's Cannes Film Festival. The feature-length film documents a journey made by dozens of Africans in a wooden boat, leaving the Senegalese capital, Dakar, in the hope of making it to Spain and a better life. The boat hits a storm and most of the passengers never make it to this promised land. Film festivals, both on the African continent and elsewhere, are becoming increasingly important places to showcase African films. As the quality of films being produced in Africa improves, the prizes that the festivals award are becoming even more sought after. One title which managed to secure one of these coveted awards is Yema by Algerian filmmaker Jamila Sarawi. Despite having no acting experience, Jamila played the lead role of a mother who suspects her son of being a mujahideen.
I didn't know how to act, but I told myself, I'm going to do it because I know the script well. It was me who created this woman, so she must be a bit like me. So I said, let's go, because I'm sure she looks like me.
While African film has often struggled to keep up with the technical mastery of its Western counterparts, there are signs this year that this is slowly changing. Prosper Dar is from Burkina Faso's main broadcaster, RTB, and was closely following the festival.
What has marked this festival is the increase in technological professionalism. There are less amateur filmmakers. The themes have also changed. There are fewer stories from the pre-colonial period. They're now stories about current events, the difficulties of today's life and religion. In Africa today, we are very religious and poor. When you're poor, religion is something you can take refuge in. This is a character of today's Africa.
Robin G is a judge on the newly formed Ambassador's Prize, presented by the US Ambassador in Burkina Faso.
Some of the films coming out of Morocco and Algiers have a particular quality and style to it that seems to be different from, say, for example, Senegal or Burkina or Mali. So the quality is not what I expected, I think, but I'm hopeful. I still have 11 films to see.
So despite the problems facing African filmmakers, lack of funding, lack of cinemas, piracy, and the ever-present cultural weight of Hollywood, FESPACO still have something to offer. And for now, it's a testament to an African film industry, which is alive and well. For Monocle in Ouagadougou, this is Rose Skelton.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're back after this to talk Saudi Arabian art.
Movie making is in the DNA of Berlin, from the celebrated film festival to the legendary Babelsberg Studios. Monocle Films takes a look at the German film industry and its soft power potential.
You know, all the pictures which are shot in Germany on German locations is a possibility to export pictures from Germany into other countries. And that is, I think, something which is of value. It's not of big economical value, but I think it's a large image value which can be improved by that.
The Currency of Celluloid Dreams, premiering now on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. And we're going to stay right here in London as we look at the Art 13 Art Fair, which just finished here in West London. In a mega-crowded art fair marketplace, Art 13 is a modern and contemporary fair, getting known for some quality galleries, works and visitors, showcasing thousands of artworks from 129 international galleries spread across 30 countries. On the agenda was a panel discussion led by Jeddah's Attar Gallery, a key player in discovering and nurturing art in Saudi Arabia, building a collector and educational base, and forging relationships with international institutions and galleries. I caught up with Attar's co-founder, Mohammed Hafiz, and Middle East art expert, Alia Al-Sanusi, in London before the fair to hear about the role of the Attar Gallery and how the art world is increasingly looking to the Middle East.
We've been reaching out to the world for a very long time now. And in terms of the art movement, we'd like the world to come in and see what we're doing. We just came from an event in Jeddah called the Jeddah Art Week. That was a great success for us that we'll keep on doing every year. So it's a sort of an exchange that we want to carry on and keep doing.
And obviously Art 13 is an art fair. It's quite it's quite unlikely and unusual often that the sort of proper creative seeds are sown in a commercial environment. Alia, you're on the panel for this talk
yes.
as well. How does that work? It seems that maybe the Middle East is slightly different in that respect, in the commercial and the creative mix a little more.
I think that it's an interesting thing that happens in the Middle East, more so than really anywhere else, where you see commercial institutions or commercial events such as Art Dubai, such as Art 13 now, and such as a gallery like Mohammed's, you know, I think absolutely wonderful gallery, Athar, being such important drivers of culture and really important nexuses of the coming together of curators, of artists, of nonprofit institutions, and also really being able to work with the government. Because while Mohammed's saying that, you know, it's now for the rest of the world to reach out to Saudi, I have to say it is really a little bit up to you guys to reach out a little bit more, because it's very hard for people to come to Saudi Arabia. It's not like anybody can just get on a plane and come visit you. So
how easy is it really, realistically, for collectors, fellow artists, curators from around the world to rock up?
You know, we're working closely with the government to arrange and make this easier and smoother for visitors to come. It's not as easy as coming to many other parts of the world. Not even Dubai is a lot easier to come into. But it's loosening up. I think it's our second year now with a sort of an event that reaches out to the rest of the world. Last year, we've done the Edge of Arabia Jeddah edition.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, as a visitor, I was absolutely blown away and so impressed with.
And Edge of Arabia is, like, we should say for the listeners, is an arts organization, which is sort of an Anglo-Middle Eastern arts organization. Am I right? It's an amazing thing that puts on amazing shows throughout Art Dubai and I guess the Sharjah Biennial and things.
It does, and they've had their recent show in London, in East London, that have brought in a very nice, interesting audience to look into art from the Middle East and the rest of the world. But I think going back to the cultural and commercial reach, the structure of the art scene in the Middle East is not as established as it is in the West. And when you look at the different elements that come into play to form the scene, the institutions and the museums and the 100-year-old institutions are not there. So it's up to, you know, more or less sort of individual private initiatives to drive the scene and take it to the next level.
I wanted to ask you about people's conception of the Middle Eastern art scene, because there seem to be two poles. There seem to be Saadiyat Island on one and a proper organic art scene such as the one in Jeddah and the Attar Gallery. Is that right? I mean, there's clearly a middle ground, there's clearly commercial ground. Maybe you could paint us a bit of a picture, Alia, of the subtleties within that, the stuff between the Attar Gallery and the hyperboles and hubris of Saadiyat.
Well, I think that the Middle East art scene is really about relationships. It's about personal relationships. I mean, it's about knowing who is sitting next to you. You know, it's not for anything that I'm sitting here next to Mohammed, who I've known for years and who we have worked together in a variety of different ways. We are friends. You know, we, you know, all go out to lunch together. And so not only are we colleagues, we're friends, and we support and help each other. And I think that you really see that when you see commercial galleries and people who are working in commercial galleries helping each other. And, you know, some things that you don't see necessarily in London, where you have a friend who works at, say, Gagosian and somebody else who works at White Cube, they'll never share the name of a client with each other.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I think in the Middle East, you know, we're all very open about that. And it's great. Yes, you should get in touch with this person. He's a collector and this person is, you know, interested in this. And it, for me, that is the kind of summation of what the Middle Eastern art scene is really about. And I think that you see it within organic art movements, like what is happening in Jeddah, like what is happening in Beirut. You know, Beirut is very strong on this. You have Christine Tomei at Homeworks in Eshkal Alwan. And I think Saadiyat Island, you know, it created a lot of buzz and it created a lot of excitement around the world. I think to a certain extent, I don't want people just to look at the Middle East and say, oh yeah, it's a bunch of rich Arabs.
Mohammed, I wanted to ask you about the preconceptions people have, this idea of censorship and getting art in and out of Saudi Arabia. Is that an overplayed conception on people's behalf?
You know, this censorship issue is a very personal and subjective situation. You can't really put a sort of barriers and parameters for it. It changes from country to country, city to city, culture to culture, person to person within the same house. Some people would allow things or not. And we've seen things censored in the West that are maybe pro sort of an idea that comes from our part of the world and the other way around. Now, the way we look at it in Athar Gallery is we'd like to be very frank about what we want to say to the rest of the world, yet be respectful for our cultures. We have parameters that we believe in that we don't want to cross. And we think the smart art is the one that can deliver the message clearly, yet stay respectful for anything that happens around it. We don't want to provoke anyone. It's very easy to be provocative in the art world, but it's difficult to be respectful and strong with the message you bring across. And whatever we show in Dubai or in London is something we can show in Saudi Arabia. So we don't take the advantages or chances that we're traveling. We try to stay very consistent.
And I've got to ask you a question that before we leave that I'm sure lots of our listeners will be kind of wanting to know the answer to. Not in Saudi Arabia necessarily, but across the Middle East. Has the Arab Spring changed the nature of the art that you both have seen in the last couple of years? Have there been strong responses to that? Or is it kind of too young? Is it too much in its infancy to really see stuff on gallery walls that's addressing that?
I mean, I was with you guys here in Monaco last year talking a little bit about this right when it was all happening, and particularly talking about Libya, of course, as I'm Libyan. I think that, of course, the Arab Spring has been a subject for artists in the Middle East, but it's been a subject for artists worldwide. And I think people are fascinated by the Middle East. There is something very exotic and romantic about it, yet it's very close. I mean, Libya is 2.5 hours flight from London, or, you know, 3-hour flight from London. And so, of course, people are very aware of what's happening in the Arab Spring. It affects, you know, the world, you know, oil prices and, you know, various, you know, issues of domestic security. But I wouldn't necessarily say that artists are only going to be discussing the Arab Spring from now on.
It's kind of that thing. It's kind of what we expect, right? You do this thing. It's like thinking that you can't paint something naughty in Saudi Arabia. Do you know what I mean? It's a similar kind of misconception that people have. It's a rather kind of orientalist kind of idea of it, I guess, as well, right?
Yeah.
No, I think artists would address it. It's
interesting.
The art scene is a reflection of what happens in a society. And artists would either talk about their personal experiences, and we've seen some amazing artists coming from Egypt and Libya and all of the Arab Spring countries talking about their personal experiences in the Tahrir Square, here, there. And these are how they express themselves, and the world would hear about them. And Saudis who would talk about, Saudi artists who would talk about it, British ones, American. I think the interesting thing about the art world is it's the sort of the pulse of the world in a very interesting, exciting language.
That was Mohammed Hafiz, co-founder of Athar Gallery, and Alia Al-Sanusi, who are in town for the Art 13 Fair, which has just come to a close. To find out more about the Athar Gallery, go to atharart.com, and that, if you'll forgive my pronunciation, is atharart.com. Still to come in part two, we'll be delving into a Midori House session with the beautiful Cold Specs. We'll hear about the station championing slow TV in Norway, and we'll find out what happened at Lahore's first ever literary festival. So to kick off the second half of the show, another delightful Midori House session. Cold Specs is the moniker of Toronto-born, London-based musician Al Specs, whose blend of bleak, doomy emotive sounds and impressive gospel-tinged vocals create a surprisingly seldom-explored subgenre in the classic soul canon. She stopped by Midori House to lay down a couple of songs in an intimate studio session, and from that, this is Lay Me Down.
Mother, mother, I am weak. Father, father, don't you fear. The ground is what this blood knows. We simply greet it and rest. All I ask of you now is to lay me down, lay me down, lay me down, lay me down. With my last breath, my soul will slip. With my last breath, my soul will slip. With my last breath, my soul will slip. Well, the ground is what this blood knows. We simply greet it and rest. And brother, brother, when the time comes, will you smoke this history? Burn my name when you lay me down. Lay me down, lay me down, and lay me down, lay me down. When you lay me down, lay me down, and lay me down, lay me down. When you lay me down, lay me down, when you lay me down. When you lay me down, when you lay me down, lay me down, when you lay me down.
That was Cold Specs with Lay Me Down, and after singing her beautiful lungs out, she sat down with Tom Hall for a wee chat.
What's the story behind those tunings? Because you don't play a conventional setup.
No, I think it's an open C minor, but the two low strings are quite random. It's just, I picked six notes on the keyboard that I liked and tuned my guitar to it, and it was really pretty open tuning. It allowed me to play kind of Arabic guitar stylings, but it sounds really nice open as well. I just really liked it, so I stuck with it.
I was doing a bit of research and I saw something that said that you'd almost run away to London. Is there any truth behind that?
I had some money that I was going to pay my tuition with and didn't do that and booked a flight out and never left. I didn't really tell anyone in my family or anything and kind of just left and tried it out. It's all good now and
So, I mean, today, you're on a borrowed guitar. I mean, that's because your regular is somewhere in Somerset, right? You're recording your album.
Yeah, I left it in Somerset. I'm recording. I usually play a thin line Telecaster. It's really nice and play everything on it. And at the moment, I'm recording in Somerset and it's at the home studio, I guess. I'm living in a cottage in the middle of nowhere by the Glastonbury tour.
Right. And who are you recording with out there?
That's Jim Anderson, a guy named Jim Anderson. He produced the first record. I always say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And it ain't broke, so I'm not fixing it. So he's got the job for the second record.
And is that, are you doing work with Rob Ellis again? Like Rob Ellis is the famous collaborator with PJ Harvey. And they all knock around out there, don't they? Kind of Somerset way, like the West Country.
Yeah,
PJ
and Rob lives about 20 minutes from where I'm living. He drummed. Rob's a producer by trade, but he's also an amazing drummer, and he's an arranger. So with the first record, it gets mixed up in the press sometimes, but Jim produced the first record and Rob drummed and did arrangements. So for the second record, I mean, he's the best drummer I've ever met, so he'll probably be drumming on the record.
And just out there doing the session now, you did one completely a cappella. Is that, I mean, you say you're more of a singer than a guitarist. Is that something you do regularly during live shows, just put down the instrument and belt one out like that?
That particular song is called Old Stepstone, and it's a traditional song, and I just sang it a cappella when we recorded it. And it's kind of got picked up on by blogs and stuff, and I sang that song on Jules Holland, so it's not on the record, but it seems to be their most well-known song. So I tend to end all of the sets with that song, and it's also just pretty easy for me to do.
I'll cherish fond memories where I'm far away, to roam over this wide world alone.
There's quite a traditional feel to your music. I mean, you know, doing songs a cappella like that, I mean, there's quite a sort of old school kind of soul, almost gospel feel to some of it. I mean, you're quite young and you sort of have this very quite world-weary voice. I mean, do you kind of embrace melancholia like that? Are you kind of, are you quite an old soul?
Not really. I'm pretty immature. like watching American Dad and South Park, and I just have a deep husky voice.
Right.
I don't know. I never really sat down and thought I'm gonna write a kind of a gospel song or a blues song. Kind of just I was just writing songs in very basic form in the beginning, just me and a guitar, and naturally, I guess, with this tone of my voice and the subject matter as well, and the themes involved. I guess with all of those things combined, it kind of had naturally got, it sounded more like gospel songs and sort of sad blues songs, but it's not really something I sought out, but it just kind of turned out that way.
Yeah. I mean, is there much of that sound around, you're from like Toronto originally. I mean, is that something that you kind of absorb from where you live, or is it in the old records that you've seeked out? I mean, how did your sort of taste develop that way?
I was never really a part of the Toronto music scene, but it's got there's a pretty great folk scene out there at the moment, but I've never really been a part of it. I just was really into soul singers, and I just was really into people like James Carr and really like Tom Waits as well, and I think that it just kind of naturally came out that way. I don't know, I'm not really good at analysing my own stuff.
And the new album, I mean, is that just kind of in its kind of embryonic stages, or is that anywhere near finished?
No, it's not. I'm just sort of just writing and demoing up. Some songs are done. There's a song called All Flesh is Grass that we play live. It's finished, and there's some other songs that are done, but I'm going to take my time with it, I think, over the next year or so.
That was Cold Specs talking to Tom Hall there, and a new album, I Predict a Graceful Explosion, is out now. She's playing London this week and then goes on tour across Canada and the US. Go check her out, and we'll be hearing another track from her at the end of the show. This is Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we're off now to chop some logs, because Norway's national craze with slow TV has hit another milestone. Burning Wood. 1 million viewers turned into NRK2 on February the 15th to watch the 12-hour National Firewood Evening programme, featuring authors, musicians, forestry workers and wood enthusiasts, while logs crackle in the background, inspired by the surprise bestseller Hel Ved, Strong Wood. The show is a follow-up to its successful Slow TV predecessors, live filming of an eight-day cruise up Norway's picturesque northwest coast and an eight-hour train ride from Bergen to Oslo. Lise-Mai Spissøy, project leader for National Firewood Evening, there is such a thing, spoke to reporter Valeria Cristione about Norway's fascination for Slow TV and wood.
Our thought was to show our love to firewood and to inform people about firewood. What kind of firewood should you go for? How do you chop best your firewood? How do you burn it without polluting? So we wanted to inform about firewood, but also talk about all the feelings we have connected to firewood. We have a sort of tradition in Bergen to make slow TV. So this is one of the slow TV ideas we have got. And for National Firewood Evening, it started with this surprisingly bestseller book by Lars Mytting, Hel Ved, or Solid Wood. This was a best-selling book that Christmas, and we discovered that it's a huge interest around firewood out there in Norway. So why not make TV out of it? It's so many sides of firewood, so the ideas came very easily. What to talk about, what to show, and many enthusiastic people to invite who could talk about firewood and health, firewood and culture, firewood and security, and so on. So it was easy to come up with ideas around firewood. We put plenty of wood into the fire. We had one camera staring with the viewers into that fire all through the night and to the morning at 8 o'clock. So the only excitement then were when does the photographer put more logs into the fire? And now and then she fried some sausages and marshmallows. I think slow TV is something that people like to watch. It's different from the ordinary TV programs you usually watch. And I think the important thing is the idea. Is this something that people recognize and have some kind of relationship to? And I think the travel along the coast with Hurtigruten and traveling by train and now firewood is all things that Norwegian can relate to. And so you find something you recognize, and the slow TV is appealing.
It's awakening Norwegian identity.
Yes, I think you are right. It's a lot about identity. I know there were 3 times more viewers on this channel during the firewood evening compared to a normal night.
Really? On primetime Friday?
Yes.
Is this a concept that a commercial TV station in Norway could have pulled off equally as successful?
Yes, I think they could, but it would have been a great chance, of course. And they have advertisers and boards to convince. NRK can take that chance, and if you don't get any viewers, well, we failed, but we haven't lost a lot of money and advertisers. So it's important that non-commercial TV channels take risks like this, I think.
So, of course, the big question is, what's next? How do you talk burning wood?
We have got ideas like watch painting dry or grass grow. I think maybe not, but Absolutely. We are open for more ideas.
But it sounds like you have a theme going where it's Bergen-based and it's, again, the theme of Norway's national identity and people feeling a bond with what they're watching.
It was an idea that came in Bergen with our colleagues. And it was basically during a lunch break, a normal day, they were about to make an ordinary story about Bergensbanen, this train between Oslo and Bergen, and thought, as a frame around this story, let's make the whole trip, tape the whole trip. And then the idea came, why not make that the program, the trip in true time? And that was a pretty crazy idea. But for some reason, they got permission and made that program, and we discovered that people loved it. And people were thinking maybe, okay, I can watch for 3 minutes. And there they were, 3 hours afterwards, still watching this trip. And the same was for Hurtigruten, and the same goes for Firewood Evening.
That was Lisa Mai Spissui talking to Valeria Cristione. And if you'd like to see wood burning for yourself, you can still check it out at tv.nrk.no. You're listening to Culture with me, Rob Bounds. It's Monocle 24. Next stop, Lahore.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Maranushi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to Culture, where to finish today's show, we're off to Pakistan. Lahore has, in its rich history, been ruled by Hindu kings, Mughal emperors, Sikh monarchs and British sovereigns, and everyone from author Rudyard Kipling to Sufi poet Faiz Ahmed Faiz has chronicled its transformations. The city's first ever literary festival, which took place in late February, celebrated that heritage and, as Saima Tariq discovered, heralds a bright future for Pakistani writing.
So in me as a writer, you know, one of the happiest days of my life, I'm really happy.
Celebrated author Mohsin Hamid is speaking at his hometown's first ever literary festival about his new novel, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. The Lahore Literary Festival, held in the vast and modern brick halls of the Alhambra Centre, has gathered writers, activists, journalists and political thinkers to address audiences literally spilling out into the aisles. Women dressed in full veils sit alongside t-shirt-clad students, and members of the literary elite mingle with aspiring writers and poets. It is the second event of its kind in the country, the first being the well-established Karachi Literature Festival. Pakistan has long been grabbing attention for less than positive reasons. In the last few years, its literati have only been talking more about the state of their country. It's no surprise then that every session of the festival is full, says BBC correspondent and LLF delegate Lise Doucette. We meet backstage as a dance performance is taking place in the main theatre.
Of course there should be a festival in Lahore, because it has always been, through history, a hub of culture and heritage, but it's the first one. And so you think, are people going to come? Is it going to be a success? Today, every hall is packed, even though there's three events at the same time. There's such a buzz here. And the loveliest thing of all is that you meet lots of students, lots of people, you know, in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and older people. And so it's drawing a cross-section of Pakistani society and discussing all kinds of issues, from the media to film to the question of what kind of a state is Pakistan, what is the role of religion, what is the identity of Pakistan. I was just on this panel of resistance. It's such a lovely, vibrant atmosphere.
The festival program's diversity shows a commitment to national as well as international talent. While William Dalrymple holds a presentation on his book about the 19th century British invasion of Afghanistan, another hall has three Lahori architects discussing urbanism in their city. The exclusively Urdu writer Intizar Hussain draws as much of a crowd as London-based political thinker Tariq Ali. Books written in Punjabi, Urdu, Sindhi and English are flying off stores at all hours, and people are chatting, reading and getting their books signed by passing celebrities in the sunshine outside. Booker Prize nominee Mohammed Hanif, author of A Case of Exploding Mangoes and a Reluctant Fundamentalist, gives his thoughts on what this new festival means for the country's bookworms.
I mean, what it tells us is that there's a moneyed middle class. The kids go to private schools, so they can read and write. And they have the time to come out to these festivals, and they have the money to buy these books. That's what it tells me about Pakistan. But as I was saying in my earlier session, that we live in a time where kind of, you know, things are getting darker. So I guess one can't help, you know, reflecting that. And there's lots of great stuff happening in Urdu and in Sindhi especially. There's some really good short story writers, and there's some really brilliant poets in Sindhi. So I think that's probably the most exciting bit of Pakistani literature. There's very little that gets translated into English. In fact, there's very little that gets translated from one Pakistani language to another. I hope people will keep writing and people will keep reading. There are many more publishing houses now than there were. And there are many more books being published now than there were in the past. So I think that will keep happening.
Baba, main parat nahi, jehdi teri parchhati te behrawangi.
In a nation commonly seen as dangerous for women, the number of female readers and writers attending the festival is a surprise to much of the audience and the next morning's national press. But they are boosting the national book trade, as writer and literary journalist Muniza Shamsi explains.
Oh, I think it's very good. I mean, actually, there are a lot of young women writers, and a lot of them are not getting as much attention as they should. But they are really good writers that I've mentioned. I mean, you've got the major ones, one or two of the major ones, but some of the others are also writing rather unusual work. They're tackling history, they're tackling things like the 1971 war, they're tackling partition. There's a wonderful writer called Surya Khan, she's written about both. You've got a young woman in Canada called Shabano Bilgrami, she's written a most beautiful novel, Without Dreams. There's Shaza Fatma Heather today, whose book I haven't actually read, but I've heard much about it. I think it's certainly an indication of a lot of things. You see, one of the things that's happened is, for one thing, our own writers. You know, you should see how packed all the sessions are. You get Danyal, you get your own are drawing huge crowds. And that is because they're writing. You know, when you read, there is a tremendous kind of pleasure that one gets about reading about your own country. And there's a kind of excitement, there's a kind of buzz about the younger generation. Publishing fiction hasn't developed, but I think it will. I think it's a matter of time. I think it's still very new. I think it's been very sudden, this sudden outburst of talent. And people are still a little puzzled. They wonder if it's got to do with the war of terror. Actually, the two things have coincided. You know, it's like snowball, isn't it, that, you know, people start looking at Pakistani fiction seriously. They think, oh yes, and the place is topical, and then the good writing starts gathering snow. So I think it works like that.
It is said that Pakistan's biggest export is its people, but its literature of all kinds is also making wave outside its borders. The national industry now needs to harness this talent for a growing and inquiring readership. For Monocle in Lahore, I'm Saima Tariq.
So that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be hearing about the world's largest philosophy festival and hearing what TV formats are making money in Africa and West Asia at this year's Discop TV Industry Conference in Istanbul. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilbao, and Holly Fisher hung up her skis and came back to help us make it all good and cosy again. Time for one final song this week from her beautiful Midori House session. This is Cold Specs with The Mark. Thanks for tuning in.
He left his mark upon my skin, said I lost my loose heart to the cold, cold wind. Swallow me, hunted down, I didn't know how to send him out. Cross your heart, remember me, a good father, I was a bad seed. I left it whole, I left it clean. Now I'm a collection of memories. Take my body home. Take my body home. Cross your heart, remember me. A good father, I was a bad seed. Take my young body home. Take my body home. If I go before you do, coming for to carry me home. I'll cut a hole and pull you through. Coming for to carry me home. Take my body home. Take my body home.